Hello and welcome to the D2C Leaders podcast, a series brought to you by Commerce Centric. My name is Philip Driver, founder and CEO of Commerce Centric, the direct-to-consumer experts. And together with my guests, we will be deep diving the most important topics around direct-to-consumer and e-commerce. You will hear from the top leaders in their field on how they faced and overcame the big D2C challenges and their thoughts on the future of e-commerce. Learn what you need to stay ahead and to take your business direct-to-consumer. Hi, and welcome to another D2C Leaders podcast. Today, I'm super excited because we've got a good friend of mine, Imtiaz Ahmed, coming in from RB to talk about D2C. Newly minted head of direct-to-consumer for North America, but he's been working at Reckitt Benckiser a long time, so he's going to give us lots of insights about how he approaches direct-to-consumer and what his thoughts are on e-commerce are. So first of all, welcome, Imtiaz, to the podcast. Thank you very much. I know you're a big fan of kind of D2C. You've been championing that for a long time. But if you can give us a little bit of an intro just into kind of current role and some of your background, that'd be great.
Sure. Thank you, Philip. Firstly, thank you for the opportunity to come to the podcast. Lovely to speak with you and lovely to catch up. In terms of my role and what I look after right now, I look after direct-to-consumer e-commerce operations for North America for RB, which means everything from a technology point of view, how we actually get our products to customers, customer operations, so customer service, and all of the technology fronts under that as well. Yeah.
Fantastic. And you've been at Reckitt Benckiser for over a decade now, kind of, and through and you know, doing D2C that entire period. What's the biggest changes you've seen in that period?
So I started at RB as a graduate, fresh on the field, from the very, very bottom ranks of you know, the company. So when I started at RB, you know, we were very offline focused, very much so relationship building with offline retailers across grocery, pharmacy, discounter channels, and some also like B2B type channels as well, so commercial customers as well. And now what's basically changed is that specifically over the last, I would say, 4 to 5 years, the channel shift from our customers, from our onto online has only accelerated. There's a famous saying that says there are decades where nothing happens, and then there are weeks that decades happen. And that very famous meme where, you know, that outlines who has changed who's transformed technology in your business. Well, number one, your CIO, number two, CTO, or number three, COVID. Definitely COVID has really changed the in which our company and, you know, our industry vertical has had to look at the way we, you know, service our consumers as well as service our customers as well.
Fantastic. And so obviously some huge brands in the RB portfolio, but within that, and obviously within going direct to consumer, what are the key aspects or the unique challenges that your kind of product set faces?
Very good question. So within D2C, and we can break this up into two, I would break it up into two areas. One is looking at the new entrants and the new competitors that come in, the likes of your Dollar Shave Clubs, the likes of Harry's, etc. And two is trying to make an existing fulfillment and supply chain and commercial business model work for the new world. So let's address new entrants first. When you think about companies like Harry's or Dollar Shave Club, and the plethora of D2C, you know, digital native vertical brands that have entered the fold over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, what is really interesting is how much venture capital they're willing to burn in order to acquire customers. So we're talking, you know, people that are spending, you know, $30, $40, $50 to acquire a customer that a lifetime value might only be basically $40 or $50, or even the first purchase doesn't equate to the actual acquisition cost. So when you're an incumbent, when you're a big company that's been in a particular industry, very, you know, stable customers with very stable profitability, and you have a new entrant that's basically acquiring your customers but making no money from it, it's certainly a very big commercial challenge. So, you know, what do, or how do, you know, companies like mine react to that, and how have companies like mine reacted to that as well? So, you know, that we look at new entrants as one threat or one side of the equation. The other side is, you know, when you're operating in low value, very commoditized categories, how do you actually make a one unit order P&L actually work? So if you're selling shavers, for example, where people are spending, you know, I don't know, between $15, $20, maybe $30 per year, and your average cost of fulfillment for that, you know, particular order might be in the order of $6 to $10, and then your acquisition cost might be $6 to $10, it doesn't leave a lot of room for margin or profitability left on the table. So one of the things that we've had to look at is how do we change our organization to move towards order level economics rather than case level economics?
So in terms of making a P&L work, it starts with being able to reconcile a single unit transaction within your organization. Then it moves to, okay, now I have these, you know, different costs. So I have to factor into account, these fulfillment costs that I'm used to, you know, I'm used to selling to a Tesco or a Walmart in a pallet or a full truckload, but now I have to ship this, you know, in one individual particular product to a user. So, you know, all of these challenge, all of these, you know, different business aspects of actually doing the operations of D2C, we've had to, you know, face and we've had to meet with the challenge. But that said, you know, it's forced us to look at, you know, why do customers actually really, you know, enjoy using our brands? What utility do we actually bring to the fold that, you know, our competitors haven't done? So, you know, given COVID has happened, given that you know, people aren't going out to store as much as before, you know, the demand for digital, the demand for, you know, finding and discovering new products that solve problems online has only increased. That's not to say that, you know, brand heritage as well as brand saliency that, you know, historical brands such as Dettol has built over time has no value. But it is to say that when people are needing something right now, when they are signaling on Facebook, on any other platform that they're actually in need of a product, how do we surface ourselves there first and then have the right user journey to actually be able to, you know, possibly fulfill that problem with a solution, whether that be a product specifically, which is, you know, the area that I work in, or potentially with a service as well.
And you spent a lot of that time, I guess, just building the infrastructure to do that, so changing the infrastructure to kind of make that happen. I guess that was the core challenge of the early days, perhaps.
Yes. So, having partners like SAP, who are a global partner for us across, you know, multiple regions and markets, we have different capabilities in terms of how we reconcile and do our finances. So in some instances, we've had to look externally to work out how do we do these unit level transactions with customers. So that means, you know, doing an RFP, looking at the capabilities, ensuring that those merchant of record and seller of record partners can actually come in and meet our requirements for our internal systems and actually enable us to do D2C.
And then on the, you know, as part of that, but on the front end as well. So how important within that is technology and platform to the success of D2C?
It is super, super important. I always bring this back, and I always bring digital back into three things: digital and e-commerce and all this, you know, the new way of business. For me, is down to three things: one, people; two, process; and three, platforms. So specifically on the platform front, you need to have technology that you need to have platforms that enable speed and enable the actual users to make the users of that technology and the front end people be able to actually make changes as fast as your competitors. So let me give you an example. If you're on a legacy system that requires a business user to brief a business analyst to brief a developer to put that into to do build a solution to then have it QA'd, then you know, go through a business acceptance to actually publish something, and that cycle takes, I don't know, 15 to 20 days. Whereas, you know, at a startup or one of your one of our digital native competitors, you know, that process might be a few minutes. You know, inherently we become too slow to actually even compete. So this is one of, you know, one of the reasons why I'm a massive advocate for technology solutions that enable front-end users or, you know, commercial business owners to actually do the execution themselves, rather than needing multiple internal stakeholders and, you know, people to actually, you know, push something to life. That agility that you need to, you know, operate in this new world has only gone up by a factor of 100x, and that is actually a competitive advantage right now, and that is enabled through having the right technology to do D2C.
Mm-hmm. And I know that RB is operating on Shopify, which I know you also helped champion in Europe to get that kind of off the ground and integrated into the systems. What particularly drew you and RB to that platform?
Very good question. So we had been on other platforms. I'm not going to name the platforms, but quite big enterprise level, both enterprise level platforms, as well as even, you know, I would say very common, smaller scalable platforms that a lot of, you know, early 2000 e-commerce companies were using as well. So this Shopify was actually the third platform that we moved to within my tenure. And the reason we kind of really like Shopify is it goes back to my point about speed and agility. It's the ability for me as a commercial user to actually sit in a cafe or sit remotely and to make changes on the website if I wanted directly from my mobile phone. Right from, you know, my iPhone, whereas with previous platforms, for me to make that change, I would have to go through the process that I described to you. I'd have to log a ticket. I'd have to wait for somebody to prioritize that ticket. You would have to go through a cycle, and that speed to launch was just slow. Now, that goes also like goes down to maturity, digital maturity as well. So if you're just starting out, and if you just want to validate some D2C ideas, Shopify is a great platform to do that because it is not very code heavy, and you don't necessarily need a massive amount of developers to kind of get started and to get going and to, you know, just smoke test an idea. Whereas if you go with an old, you know, an enterprise level full grade e-commerce solution, you automatically lose ability, specifically if you don't have a already validated idea. If you have an existing business model, an existing e-commerce business model that really works, that needs enterprise level, you know, portfolio management of SKUs, for example, or you know, you need to run 50 different websites using the same type of theme or setup, yeah, fine, an enterprise level e-commerce solution might be a better way of going at it. But if you just want to start small and you know, test things out, Shopify is probably, from my opinion, is the best platform out there to go with at the moment.
Okay. And what's Shopify like to work with kind of day to day, kind of when you're doing the merchandising and your everyday tasks there? What benefits has it brought on that front?
Number one is agility. So the speed in which we can make change. Number two is the clarity in the sense of the data and the way that it natively plugs into so many different things. So for example, you know, plugging in GA to Shopify for, you know, it's just you paste in your GA number and it's done. And then to upgrade from GA, you know, basic to enhanced e-commerce, you click a checkbox and it's done. So, you know, that is a really cool feature of Shopify. And then again, if you come up with an idea to test, say for example, you want to test pop-ups, or you want to test a different type of checkout flow, or if you want to test bundling, all these, you know, sorts of things, Shopify has various apps that you can test on their app store relatively cheaply and quickly. You can put that in front of your live users. And if that works, if that's, you know, cool, then you can actually, you know, push that into production and have it going. And if the cost of the app is too expensive, but then you see the actual value coming through in terms of incremental conversions, then you can, you know, leverage your developers or outside developers to build something like a private app for you and put that into your Shopify store as well. And that's not relatively expensive either. So it's this inherent flexibility and the speed again, which, you know, really, I'm really a fan of Shopify.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm aware you're pretty keen on, well, not just the apps and plugins, but, you know, anything MarTech that can kind of help you move along at pace. And you touched on it a little bit there, but when you are choosing, you know, what tech to plug in or what kind of platforms to kind of integrate with, how are you approaching that? Or is it test and learn like you talked about there, or is it a little bit more, is it commercial, or is it do you have a methodology behind how you approach picking these different apps and platforms?
Yes, we do. So we would never put a Shopify app into production on a live store without testing it first. So all of our stores, we have dev stores, basically a duplicate of each one of our stores. So if we have an idea on one of our dev stores, we literally just buy one of these apps, put it on the test store, test out the functionality and what it's, you know, doing with all of our other pieces of technology that are existing on the store and the other apps that are playing on the store, and just validate that it's the right thing. The other thing that we're also doing, and I, you know, I highly recommend everybody to be doing this, especially at enterprise scale, is doing your own vendor security checks and GDPR compliance. So each one of these stores each one of these apps before we're launching, we're verifying their security credentials, we're verifying their GDPR compliance and documenting that accordingly before we're pushing them out to test. So I think that's, you know, given we're in the context of GDPR now, I think that's a mandatory thing that everyone should be doing. But then in terms of working out whether or not, you know, do these three apps that I want to do X with actually works, it's actually having a set of functional requirements from each one of those commercial users that are going to actually be administering and using those apps, and then putting it through like a very basic cost versus benefit analysis, and then taking it from there. So, you know, we've done quite a few of these evaluations across subscriptions, across email capture, across the way we display our PDPs. So by doing, you know, by having this very, it's not, it doesn't need to, the great thing about Shopify is it doesn't need to be this rigorous, crazy, intense process. You can actually relatively do it on the cheap, considering the monthly app costs of most of these apps are so cheap. And most of the app developers are willing to help you out in terms of validation, especially if you're a big company, to make sure your requirements are met in terms of the solution you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. And of all the apps or tech solutions you've used or trialed, what have you been most impressed by? Which one has kind of done things that you were either not expecting or has worked perfectly?
Okay, I can answer this in two ways. One is Shopify itself. One of the things that really impresses me about Shopify is the way in which that they're actually listening to their customer base as Shopify Plus. So in terms of improving the Shopify Plus experience for Plus customers, so basically their enterprise level customers, they have really been working towards, you know, solving our problems. So that's, you know, across creating automated workflows with Shopify Flow, that's with having multi user interfaces, that's also with, you know, things like subscriptions. So Shopify itself is constantly working on improving the merchant experience on its platform, which is super cool. And another app that I'd love to plug, I actually want to plug two. One is glue.io, that's spelled GLEW.io, which is a very cool analytics platform that plugs very nicely into Shopify, GA, Facebook Business Manager, Google Ad Manager, and, you know, various other, you know, e-commerce tools as well. So that very quickly gives you analysis on how your campaigns are performing, how your product, you can plug in your, you know, product cogs to look at return on your ROI, down to return on, you can plug it in and look at return on gross margin rather than just return on revenue. So that's a very cool tool. And another one is parabola.io. Parabola is a tool that enables you to export data outside of Shopify and plug it into multiple different, you know, outlets. So think about it like Zapier, but a lot more enterprise.
Interesting. I was aware of Glue, but the other one's new to me, so we'll definitely be having a little look at that as well. So obviously technology transforms the market quite rapidly, but other external factors doing, obviously the biggest external out of the blue factor that's really changed the landscape recently is COVID-19. What's your business experience been like of the COVID epidemic? What have you seen from a D2C point of view?
Yeah, COVID's brought enormous change to the business, especially when you're working in categories or industries where you have must-need products. So I work in an industry, in the US, I'm managing a baby formula business. Obviously, mum and dad aren't going to stop feeding their child because of COVID. And it's very difficult for mum and dad to get to a store in order to baby formula safely at the moment. So there has been enormous shift onto e-commerce, but more specifically onto D2C as well. So COVID has brought in years of change in, you know, relative weeks. So we're seeing enormous uptick in terms of D2C adoption across a lot of our healthcare and a lot of our nutrition brands. We're seeing consumers, you know, getting and engaging in subscribe and save initiatives as well, because they don't want to have to worry about continually ordering product that they're always going to need. But also it's presented challenges in the sense that, you know, from a team point of view, we've had to adapt to this change. We've had to adapt for, you know, seeing 5, 10, 20, 30x spikes within, you know, a few hours, having to, you know, instead of rallying around a high top table in an office, we have to jump onto a Teams call to kind of sort out how do we solve this problem right now. So that's been interesting. It's also been a really interesting, you know, way of really understanding what is really important for running a business, what is really important for our customer. So, you know, we can focus on shiny new things or fancy stuff all the time, or we can really, you know, focus on ensuring we have the right products in stock and getting it to the customer in time. Like working with our fulfillment partners, and working, you know, with our courier partners, more specifically last mile courier partners, who've across the Americas have not just had to deal with COVID, but also have had to deal with protests and lots of other, you know, political factors going on in the US as well. We've had to keep customers way more informed about what's happening with their orders, what's happening with their transactions as well. So, you know, on multiple fronts, there have been challenges that have been presented to us. But at the end of the day, you know, consumers are understanding. They get that, you know, there are challenges in terms of getting product to people when you have uncertain times like we do. But at the end of the day, we're doing it.
Mm-hmm. And that's a huge amount of responsibility on D2C. And obviously, you've never been not responsible. You've been delivering products and doing it as well as you can. But to do that during an epidemic when things are difficult, and you talk about baby milk, you know, running out of baby milk is a serious thing, right? If the stores are closed, that's huge amounts of responsibility that you've had to rise to the challenge during that period. So I guess carry on.
Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, the question is kind of, was there anything really new or out of the box that you had to do to kind of to rise to that challenge, other than kind of, you know, come together? Was there any other exceptional things that you had to do?
Yeah, one of the exceptional things that we've had to do is we've had to work hand in hand with our other e-commerce partners as well. You know, given we saw enormous spikes in terms of demand on our website and from our supply chain, we had to look at, you know, giving other retailers some of our traffic when we were out of stock on our website. So the likes of Amazon, etc., if they had stock, we'd speak to them to service that customer demand, because at the end of the day, mum needs to get her milk for her baby, and it's not necessary. And if we can't do that on our site, it's super important that she, you know, gets it from another retailer or from another offline retailer. It doesn't really matter. She needs to get that product, and we will always take the responsible way of getting that to her.
Mm-hmm. Great. Do you think COVID's changed or accelerated the need for businesses to change how they sell, especially on D2C channels?
Yeah, I think specifically from a discovery point of view, if you're a brand that's always relied on shelf presence in the likes of Walmart or Tesco for, you know, brand discovery, then and you don't overinvest, or you don't have an offline a marketing strategy for discovery and awareness, then, you know, how does your brand interact with not just millennials, but now it's everybody, simply because no one's going to be able to discover you anymore, because, you know, there is limited outdoor experiences, or should be limited outdoor experiences, given that we have this pandemic. So I think certainly, you know, when I look at numbers that I think Target has published numbers that their click and collect more than doubled over COVID. So there are all of these customers now that or consumers now that have tried online for the first time, and they had all of these hesitations before for doing so, and now they're going to be converts. So do I see a more permanent shift to digital channels and e-commerce channels being preferred over offline? Definitely. However, is there going to be always going to be a blend of offline to online? For sure. But that discovery piece, I think, is now more than ever changed. And that's happened a lot faster than we thought it was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay, just moving away from COVID now. And Ellie, you talked about having to change infrastructure to be able to kind of suddenly sell one thing instead of the pallets of things. One of the other kind of challenges that we see when we speak to kind of big brands is how they start to change their marketing as well to align that to D2C. Because normally, again, that's not set up for individual consumer conversations. It's set up from a brand perspective. How do you think this can be achieved when someone's going direct to consumer or you know, changing the way they operate direct to consumer? And what's RB doing around this area?
Yeah. So I can speak to this at a more general level. I think, you know, traditional FMCGs, we have marketers that are very good at awareness level marketing. They are very good at, you know, reaching lots of customers, lots of consumers at mass scale using the likes of TV or even like online digital, online video, a lot of reach and awareness campaigns on Facebook. And a lot of these, you know, awareness level marketing tactics. Now, when you move into D2C, it's a very different marketing ballgame. You need acquisition specialists. You need people that are using different ad types within Facebook. They have different understanding of how Google search works, etc. So I think to address marketing within the context of D2C, you actually either need to upskill your existing marketers to understand how acquisition-focused marketing works within the digital context now, or you need to hire externally and bring in this talent internally. There also, I want to call out a massive gap within FMCG is retention marketing and CRM. So a lot of brands will be very focused on awareness, but not very focused on retention. So what I mean by this is how, for your super, super loyalists, the people that, you know, buy your brand week in, week out, how do you ensure that you know their names, you know their email addresses, you know the products that they like? How do you make those super loyalists become people that actually advocate your brand and do your selling for you? This is something that I think a lot of FMCGs have been quite weak on. And again, retention marketing specialists aren't very common in FMCG, and you certainly need that for D2C.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And outside of that, what's the biggest challenges that D2C leaders need to be thinking about, do you think?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge D2C leaders have, especially when you're working within legacy organizations, is how D2C is seen within the business. What I mean by that is if your business thinks that D2C is just another e-commerce channel, is just another Amazon, is just another brick and click, you've kind of missed the point of D2C. D2C, if you just treat it as a channel, then you think it's another incremental channel to launch on, and it's just purely about a sales-driven initiative, you've kind of missed the point. The point of D2C, number one, is the full funnel data analysis and insights that it kind of unlocks. So all of this awareness that you're doing across multiple channels, how do you measure the effectiveness of that down to the right at the bottom of the funnel where consumers are actually converting? So this is the first time that FMCGs have had access to this level of quality information about who their users are, what are they purchasing, what frequency are they purchasing those items, which channels are they converting from, what are the adjacent categories that they're also interested in. If, you know, specifically when you're an FMCG, you're not just playing within one brand category, you're playing in multiple ones. So how do we actually really start tapping into lifetime value of customers, of consumers across our digital footprint? Business does not view D2C as something a lot bigger than just a channel. They fundamentally miss the point, and they will basically quit very quickly because they will just say, this particular D2C isn't more profitable than Y customer, therefore we shouldn't be doing it and we should quit. So it really needs end-to-end thinking rather than just a very channel-specific strategy to really make the most of it.
Mm-hmm. And what advice would you have for any brands considering going direct to consumer?
The first thing I would have a think about is value proposition. So what is this value proposition that we are going to achieve by making and why into a D2C proposition? So if you just think as the saying goes, build and they will come. So if you just think you're going to build this Shopify website or any other website, and because your brand already has $500 million worth of sales, therefore, if I launch a D2C site, then automatically 10% of my customers should move to this website. That's never going to happen. So, what I would massively suggest is, if you're going to do D2C, how do you extend? How do you really think about, what utility outside of just being able to give this product to your customer directly through using a courier partner? What are the other incentives and values? What is the other value that you can actually deliver to that customer? So let me give you an example. Within baby milk formula, hand in hand with supplying this product, we have support specialists that help our customers with feeding questions, with product questions, and full service support in terms of addressing all of these concerns mums have during feeding, during this critical time in a baby's life. We have other things like subscribe and save, making it easier for mum not to have to worry about how much formula she needs to buy, and making sure that she has to go to an offline store to make sure that she's got enough, because running out of baby formula is one of the biggest concerns that mum has. So all of these added benefits, developing this value proposition before you get started is fundamental, because if you're just like I said, if you're just going to think about it like another channel and just have your products displayed on your website and think that's going to make it work, you're just basically setting yourself up for failure.
Mm-hmm. And on the back of that, what does everyone get wrong about direct consumer? What are the mistakes that you see, or even you've made, kind of when business is made going direct consumer?
Yeah, a really good question. I'm trying to think about something that we haven't spoken about before. I think the thing that everyone gets wrong about D2C, specifically from a big company or a big entity point of view, is not understanding how organically present your brand is online. So just because you have a big brand in the offline world, that might not necessarily translate into the online world. Let me give you an example. So Kylie Jenner, who, you know, has one of the biggest Shopify stores, basically has zero distribution in offline stores whatsoever, but has a massive digital presence, a lot of which is organic, which she doesn't pay for, off the back of Instagram and her Instagram following, which automatically, you know, means that from a return on ad spend point of view, she can be massively efficient in terms of acquiring and retaining users. So if you have a big brand and you basically have zero organic traffic to your brand website, zero organic traffic to from your social media channels, zero, you know, organic performance from your social media channels, as well as, you know, very limited email presence, very limited SMS and messenger presence, you will struggle to build ROI positive or ROAS positive business very quickly. So whilst you are developing your D2C strategy, you should also be considering how do you develop your organic media strategy and organic presence, because your key competitors within this space massively focus on organic before they focus on paid.
Mm-hmm. Really good, thank you. And we're obviously interested in the, you know, rather than kind of what you're doing, but about the people behind D2C as well, and you know, what backgrounds they come from and kind of how they have achieved their success. And I think with you, you certainly strike me as somebody, obviously you're a D2C leader, but you also strike me as someone who's a real kind of digital evangelist. And I think one of the things from our relationship is where I think you were the first person I'd met where you were already using AI to schedule meetings. And this is, you know, quite a while ago. And little things like that, where I think you're quite interested in kind of trying these new technologies. How important do you think that's been to your overall success so far?
Yeah, everybody needs to have a process of testing and learning. And there are people that talk about test and learn, and there are people that actually do and learn. And I like to be on that latter half. So when I see something cool, when I see something that's interesting, and you know the risk of failure is super small, then I will always, you know, spend 10, 15, 20 minutes trying to test it out. So the AI meeting scheduler that I use, X.AI, I think it's like $10 a month or something. And I thought to myself, you know, I'm going to spend $10. If it doesn't work, I'll cancel it. And what's the worst that's going to happen? I think Amy from X.AI has saved me or has scheduled for me over 500 meetings. You know, if you think about each email that has saved me, I think the productivity benefit has already been over 200 hours. So 200 hours worth of benefit for me is more than the 10 or however much I pay for Amy. From a, you know, beneficial point of view, from a benefit point of view. So I always dedicate time to actually look for these, you know, tools and hacks to not just make my life easier, but also to make my teams easier. So like I was talking to you about Parabola before, Parabola.io basically automates so many of our reporting needs. It's basically saved a day a month for one of my analysts from, you know, running specific reports that we need to run. So I think you always need to have that appetite, the appetite for your curiosity in order to always be improving your business.
Mm-hmm. And aside from the appetite and kind of searching, what else do you do to kind of stay up to date with either the latest news for D2C or just technology? Kind of what are you looking at?
Yeah, I think this is a really, really good question. I think quite a few things I do here, actually. And I think the best one that I've done is actually be connected to lots and lots of industry leaders and follow them and connect with them on, you know, different social media platforms. So I have, let's call them nerds, in almost every single field that I'm interested in. So from things like AI to automation to Salesforce to Shopify, to all of these, you know, subject matters. I have an industry expert friend that I follow on social media. So I make, you know, I make the time to catch up with these people, pick their brains, present them my challenges, and, you know, really get a very deep understanding of each one of these areas that I'm, you know, super interested in. So I put a lot of time into, you know, developing and nurturing these relationships with these industry leaders, and then also, you know, keep in touch and follow them. I'm a massive fan of The Hustle, which is an email series that goes out. You can visit on thehustle.com, which, you know, is written amazingly well. If you want to learn copywriting, and if you want to learn how to do email marketing, you really need to follow The Hustle, because, you know, it has all of the important technology news, as well as, you know, startup news as well. So you can't really be in digital and not keep up with what's happening in startup, because that's basically the forefront of what's happening right now.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Okay, and of those technologies that you're following there, which technology is exciting you the most at the moment?
Yeah, very good question again. What technology excites me the most is AI and automation, and more specifically, at things that make you go, wow, that was really cool. So talking about X.AI, I had an ex-boss of mine reach out to me a few years ago, and he's like, "Oh, MTS, can we have a chat for 20 minutes? I just want to talk to you about, you know, a couple of things that I've been working on." I'm like, "Sure," and I responded to the email with @Amy, please find time to catch up with, you know, this particular boss. And then my former boss responded, "I didn't know you got a pay rise to get a PA. Well, you know, you're doing well." He works in the technology industry. He's been, you know, he's very senior as some, you know, a previous telco. And he was fooled by this AI thinking that it was a real PA. So when, you know, things like that happen, when you make people go, wow, you know, technology actually solves a real life problem and delivers that wow consumer experience, that's what's really cool. So as we, I don't want to, you know, sound like a cliche and say, talk about personalization, but as we deliver these more experiences for consumers at scale, using automation, using AI, that's, you know, really exciting, and that's, you know, really beneficial. And that's how you're going to build brand loyalty and business loyalty over the long term.
Fantastic. So, final question. What are your predictions for the future of online retail? Where do you see this sector going?
Yeah, I see the future as omnichannel. I don't think I could be wrong, but I don't see everything being 100% online, because I think there is a thrill and there is a joy of going out and shopping in the physical world. That said, I think the role of brand discovery, the role of retention marketing, the role of influencers and brand advocates, and the way that that impacts our marketing funnel, and the way that that impacts our consumer experience, I think that is stuff that's going to evolve a lot faster versus the way people, you know, receive and get products. So, you know, is it amazing that Amazon players can deliver products to customers within 2 to 3 hours, or within an hour, and in some countries within minutes? Yeah, that's amazing. But, you know, unless if that consumer is a real new consumer, or, you know, that getting that product right then and there, is the be all and end all of consumer experience, I don't think that much really changes. So ultimately, I don't think it's about channel evolution. I think it's about the ability for businesses to solve those problems for the consumers. So how do we be more helpful to a mum when she's trying to feed her child? How do we be more helpful for a user using a particular type of healthcare product impacting their day-to-day lives? So I think, you know, that's where it's a lot bigger than just retail, is where I think value in the future of, you know, business line is headed.
MTS, thank you so much for coming on the D2C Leaders podcast. That's been really insightful. I think we've scratched the surface on some of those topics. I know you could speak for hours and hours and get into a lot more depth here, but obviously we've got to keep it rounded off. But I'd love to have you back and kind of maybe deep dive a few more of these topics in the future. But for now, again, thank you so much for coming on, and I would love to speak to you soon. Thank you very much.